This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the union movement, and in particular, the Justice for Janitors campaign, one of the more exciting things to be happening on the union front right now. With me in the studio is Stephen Lerner, director of the SEIU's Property Services Division, and director also of the Justice for Janitors campaign. Stephen Lerner, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. What is the Property Services Division? It sounds like a realtor.
Well, it's a part of SEIU that 250,000 people are members of, and it describes cleaners, security, maintenance, people who take care of property, which is now one of the largest jobs in America.
Now, this includes people like at Wackenhut, security people?
It would include everything from security people. It would include the people that clean buildings. It would include people that do maintenance, superintendents. Whether it's apartments, whether it's office buildings, what's really happened in this country is almost all the jobs have been outsourced in this sector, and we're the union that helps unite people and lift their wages up.
Tell me a little bit about Justice for Janitors. How did that get going, and how is it going?
Well, let me start first with how it's going, then I'll come back to how it got going, which is we're really going through an extraordinary time in Justice for Janitors, where in the last couple months we won a lengthy strike and made a huge breakthrough at the University of Miami, where after a three-month strike, workers took their wages from $6 to $10 an hour. In Houston, Texas, we won the largest organizing campaign in the South in recent years, with 5,000 workers gaining recognition. We're bargaining that contract now and are on the edge of a citywide strike. If you sort of march across the country, you see the people you'd least expect in some people's mind, the poorest people, immigrants, who are leading the way and saying they're standing up, they're working together, and they're winning, and it's incredibly exciting.
Now, immigrants are, you would think, are a very hard group of people to organize, especially in this climate that we're in right now, because the fear is that the employer can either just fire them or call the INS on them or Homeland Security now. How have you succeeded with the immigrant workforce?
Well, in a way, that's a good segue to go back to how this all started. Because when we first started organizing Justice for Janitors, we were like a lot of unions. We were in decline. We had membership dropping. We had whole cities going non-union. We tried to deal with our growing weakness by making concessions. And we found no matter how much we gave employers back, they wanted more. And one of the key things that happened in the mid-'80s is our workforce started shifting to immigrant workers. And our union, the service employees, like a lot of unions, initially looked at these workers as enemies. And we said, they're stealing our jobs. And we fell into this myth that either because they're immigrant or because they're undocumented, they would never organize.
What about the allegation that they're stealing our jobs? You still hear that from the Lou Dobbs and Pat Buchanans of this country.
Well, what we found is that immigrants who are here because they want to work hard, they pay taxes, they want to make their lives better, and they're doing jobs that need to be done. So our union organizes all workers. Employers hire people. We organize everybody. And what we found is far from immigrants being afraid to organize, somebody who crossed an ocean, somebody who risked their life crossing a desert, that they are brave and hopeful people and, in fact, have led some of the most courageous fights in the face of police attacks, in the face of deportations and arrests, and our greatest success actually comes in organizing immigrant workers.
I didn't know that. Now, some of these immigrant workers come from countries where there is an organizing history or a union history or socialist party. Is that part of it, or is it just they come here, they see the conditions, they know just intrinsically they need a union?
Well, like everything, it's a mix, because people come, if you look at where there's a civil war in the world, that's who ends up working in buildings. But there's a large group of people who do come out of union traditions in their own countries, just as the workers that built the CIO in the 30s often came out of progressive traditions. So we have, for example, a janitor at Harvard University. He was a judge in Colombia and was targeted by death squads, immigrated to the U.S., and has become a union activist. That whether it's people who are active in political parties, unions, what you find among a lot of immigrants is this desire to make it better and a belief that if you work hard, you should be treated decently. So depending which country it is, there's no doubt there's a tradition and a connection between immigrant workers that often helps them unite and win a union here.
Then what about the difficulty with culture and language? How are you able to broaden that let's put it this way. How are you able to narrow that problem, overcome that problem?
Well, what's fascinating is workers have something in common, which is they have the same employer and the same problems. And we find in some cities we literally have dozens of countries and dozens of languages that when you talk about how you work together and you have a plan of how to make it better, that you can bridge those problems. And what's amazing is in Chicago, for example, our membership is significantly Eastern European. In addition to Latino, it's Serbian, it's Croatian, it's what are called former Yugoslavians. And at the same time people were killing each other in that part of the world, they were on strike together in the United States to win a better contract. And what's wonderful about the union is how it brings people together over issues of common concern instead of splitting people apart.
That's a great story, too. I'm speaking with Stephen Lerner, who is the director of the SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign. The SEIU is the Service Employees International Union. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine. Stephen Lerner, how did you get involved in the labor movement?
It's a long time ago, but back in the 70s, there was something called the United Farm Workers Union. And like a lot of people who had been active in anti-war and other activities and been raised in a union family, I got involved in the farm workers and got a bug, which was that if you unite workers, you build community support, you can change the world. So 30 years later, here I am having worked for a bunch of different unions, but still I'd say with the thing I learned from the farm workers, which is that we can learn a lot and we can build a movement of the poorest workers in a way that not only raises their standards and changes their life, but actually leads the whole country.
Were you working with Cesar Chavez ever?
Yeah, I did. I worked both with I was a young peripheral person, but I did do some work with Cesar. I actually, if we're doing memory lane, one of my jobs was I was on security for Cesar. And the way I got put
You were the muscle?
No, I was taller than him. And they said, who wants to be on security? And anybody who was taller than him got to stand in front of him. So if somebody shot him, it would hit you instead of them.
Now, and were there assassination threats against him?
Back in the 70s, there had been a number of attempts. And he had actually a lot of security. And there was a time where he was on a tour in New York where there was real fear that he would be assassinated. So it's funny now. It may be the stupidity of youth that I thought that was a good job to be taller than him.
And where did you go from there after you left the United Farm Workers?
I went to work both in a hospital and then a plastics factory and got married and had a kid. And then
when you went working in the factory, it was to go in there to organize, though?
It was actually an interesting mix. I was out of work, so I went to work both to eat but also to organize it. And then I went to work for the Garment Workers Union in North Carolina for many years.
And that was a J.P. Stevens campaign?
No, this wasn't the textile with J.P. Stevens. This was the ILGWU. So this was garment shops where we had, where we basically had many lengthy losing strikes but noble struggles.
So you've been in for 30 years now in the labor movement, Stephen Lerner. Over that time, the labor movement has shrunk considerably. What is the cause of that?
Well, there's a whole group of us that like to joke that it's gotten weaker every day since we've been here, so we may not be the best ones to talk about this. I think it's a huge subject, but there's a mix of things. And everybody can talk about all the changes in the economy and deregulation and neoliberalism, but I don't want to waste any time in that because that is what it is, and we don't necessarily have a lot of control on it. What I want to focus on more is what we've done wrong. And unions as a whole have not spent their time, money, or energy on trying to organize the unorganized and grow bigger. And that even though there's been progress, that if you look at that 30 years, almost all of unions' money, their political clout, their resources, their brain power has gone to how do you protect the declining base instead of how do we organize the new workers and organize the new economy. So while there's a million bad things corporations have done, I take it for granted that's their job to do bad things. That's how they get rich. The question is, most of us haven't done our job in how we build a movement of workers in this country.
Now, to protect the base, do you think the AFL spent too much money and resources in just trying to get Democrats elected to protect the base?
Well, I don't think it's just an AFL question. I think that in general, there's an awful lot of Democrats we support who in the end haven't done a lot for workers. It's interesting, we recently had the strike in Miami, and the majority of Republican Cubans endorsed the strike in Miami in card check recognition as a way to win it. It was an mainly Cuban strike, and many of the Democrats said it was too controversial. So I don't think it's a matter that we spent too much or too little. The fact is that lots of people in the Democratic Party don't particularly care about whether workers have a union. So the question for us is, whoever we support, wherever they come from, how do we say the question of workers having a union, having power, is a litmus test?
And do you actually apply that litmus test? Because for the longest time, organized labor would be supporting people just because they had a D in front of their name.
In the service employees, it's been controversial, and our president, Andy Stern, has gotten yelled at for this, but we absolutely are saying if there are Democrats that are anti-labor, we will not line up and support them. And if there's an independent who has supported our agenda, we support them. And we've supported Republicans who support a workers' agenda. It's not a matter of just voting for somebody because they have a D. It's a matter of who is going to help workers regain their rights and power in this country.
Stephen Lerner, you mentioned Andy Stern, your boss, head of the SEIU and head of Change to Win, this new formation of several unions that left the AFL-CIO. Were you in favor of that departure?
Well, let me just do one clarification. The chair of Change to Win is actually Anna Berger, not Andy Stern. And so she is now the first woman in the history of the American labor movement to run a federation.
What is the union she's from?
She's the Secretary Treasurer of SEIU. I absolutely supported.
Why did you think it was necessary? Because part of me thought, well, what a terrible time for a split in the union movement. It's losing and losing and losing, and now this is going to be more divisive. That was part of me. Part of me thought, well, I just heard John Sweeney talk, for instance, and he sounded like Brezhnev. I mean, the guy could not give a speech on Labor Day without reading the script up to his eyes.
There's a lot of cliches about if you keep doing the same thing, you're bound to get the same result. And so I'd say there's one piece, which is we were failing miserably. And the labor movement has been in precipitous decline. And there were a group of unions that said, we want to do something different. We want to spend our time, money, and energy on how you grow and how you bring more new people into the union movement. And we felt that within the AFL, we spent all our time debating on whether that was a good idea and that it didn't offer a vehicle to make the changes. And sometimes your actions speak louder than words. Specifically, this group of unions, Change to Win, believe that the way workers improve their lives in this new economy is you have to be focused on organizing whole industries to take wages out of competition so workers don't compete against each other. And within the AFL, there was increasingly this belief that every union should represent a few of these workers, a few of those workers. And so there really wasn't a strategy to build power for workers.
How have things gone now since the split? What is the relationship between Change to Win and the AFL? Do you work together on some campaigns? Are you antagonistic? Are you raiding each other's unions? I mean, what's going on?
Well, what's interesting is the people who opposed the creation of Change to Win were doomsday speakers that we'd end up raiding, we'd end up not doing politics together. And the simple fact is that in terms of politics and things where it makes sense to work together, people are working together. There's very little, if any, raiding going on. And I think people have good relationships where they need them, where there are things that matter. And in other cases, what we're able now to do is for the Teamsters, the food and commercial workers, the laborers, the carpenters, us and the farm workers who are in the Change to Win Federation, we can focus on what it takes to grow and build a stronger movement.
Some of those unions don't have the most liberal reputation. Did that seem like an odd mix to you? Because SEIU has had a very liberal tradition.
It's a funny expression because you can have a union that has a liberal reputation but isn't doing anything to win. And so what I'd look at is we have many different views on lots of different issues, but all of these unions are committed to the same notion that we need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. We need to use our strength to bring more workers into the movement. And these unions all believe that. And on certain issues, they have different beliefs. But the fact is, what we were doing before didn't work, and we had to try something new.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I'm speaking with Stephen Lerner, director of the SEIU's Property Services Division, and also director of the Justice for Janitors campaign. There was this recent NLRB decision that's going to make it harder for workers to organize because it makes almost anyone who spends 10 to 15% on the job doing the most minor supervisory task make that person into a manager and allow the employer to say, no, you can't be part of the union. How disastrous do you think that's going to be?
Well, I guess it's disastrous, and you could add all sorts of ways of how disastrous it is. In the context of we've gone from 30% of workers in unions in the private sector to 8%, what I'd say is it's more
the same?
It's more of a verification and escalation of what's already happening. So again, going back to where I started, which is we could say it's terrible, it is. We could talk about why it's bad, all the bad things. The question is, what do we do? And one of the things that's unique and exciting about the Justice for Janitors campaign is we made a decision back in 1986 that the National Labor Relations Board didn't protect the rights of workers, and we weren't going to depend on it. So we have organized in the last 10 years 100,000 workers, none of those through government-conducted elections, that we believe that when workers unite together, when they build community coalitions, when they exercise power, that you can win the union far faster than depending on a flawed government system.
How does that work in practice? I mean, why would an employer decide not to go through the government channels and just concede after a battle, I'm sure, but ultimately concede?
Because we help change their souls, don't you think? We help them.
It's got to be more than that.
What we've found is a couple things. Is we run campaigns where we unite workers, entire communities. We have strikes. We engage in civil disobedience. There's now $1 trillion in pension capital in this country that is invested in real estate, that has passed policies saying they'll only invest in properties where people are treated decently. We look at all the ways you create conditions when an employer will say, aha, I'm willing to be union because A, the consequence is worse of not being union, and B, and I think this is a really important part of our strategy, is we believe you have to organize all the employers doing the same thing at the same time. Just as you didn't organize one auto plant and try to raise wages, you organize them all. So we organize a whole city at once, and we find that if wages are like electricity, if everybody pays the same level of wages, it doesn't make much sense for an employer to resist the union because he has the same burden as everybody else.
It would seem to me just seat of the pants that organizing the whole city would be more difficult, compounding your difficulties, than organizing at one workplace. Why isn't that so?
Well, we know what happens when you organize one workplace, which is the employer just goes out of business because if you force him to pay more than everybody else, then he can't compete, or you take a lousy contract, in which case workers don't want to be in the union. So you need to have a rational way in a hyper-competitive economy to organize. But this goes back to the start. You can't organize a whole city if you don't have resources, if you're not willing to commit time, if you're not willing to take risks. So what we do is when we have a campaign, it engages thousands of workers. We have full-time community organizers. We have people who are working on how we do media relationships, how you build community coalitions. And while it may take a little bit longer in the short run, what you find is you're really trying to build a social movement.
Because it used to be that people would say a few years ago, the strike weapon is obsolete now because they're just going to, you know, they're just going to bust the union, whether they're going to do it legally or illegally. The sanctions on the illegal firing of organizers are virtually non-existent in de facto. And so people going on strike aren't going to be able to succeed. You at the SEIU and Justice for Janitors have really brought back the strike as an effective weapon.
But our conception of the strike is different, which is when we go on strike, we assume that they will successfully bring in strike breakers and that they'll get the property clean. So if we defined ourselves as did you stop the property from being clean, we would lose. But we look at the strike as a way you free workers to be full-time activists. So when we struck at the University of Miami, those 200 workers became full-time organizers. They organized the students who did an occupation of campus. They organized religious and community leaders. They went on a 17-day hunger fast where literally people were being taken off in ambulances as they passed out and united the entire community. So the question is, when you strike, what are strikers doing? And what we found is that there's nothing more exciting and wonderful than workers who are freed from the burden of working, and they can use all their talents to say, let's build a movement that pressures employers to settle.
But don't the workers suffer while they're doing it in lost wages?
Absolutely, people suffer in the short run. But people understand that if you're working for minimum wage, the only way you're going to make it better is to take a risk. In addition, like a lot of unions, we raise strike fund money. We help support people.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Stephen Lerner, who is a very inventive union organizer with the SEIU. He's been heading up Justice for Janitors, which has had enormous success against very strong odds over the last 15, 20 years. One other thing that you've been talking about, Stephen Lerner, is a global organizing effort for service sector workers. Can you explain that?
Well, I had an extraordinary experience in London a little while ago where I was meeting with a group of workers. And the workers in London were half from Colombia, South America, and other South American countries, and they were from North Africa. There were no English workers. The cleaning contractor they worked for was from Denmark, and the building owner was from New York. And so everything about their life was global. They were global workers. They had traveled across oceans to try to get to a better life. The company that employed them was global, and the capital that financed it was global. The only thing that isn't union, that isn't global, is a union. And so what we've realized is that if everybody else is global, for workers to exercise power, we have to figure out how we build a global union so that we can magnify our strength around the world to take on these corporations everywhere they operate.
Well, how do you figure that out? Because people have been talking about this since the dawn of the multinational corporation, and there was a lot of discussion back in the 80s with the International Metal Workers Federation or the Machinists Federation to do a strike in the United States and one in Germany and really leverage. How can you do it in a way that will succeed?
Well, the fascinating thing about the service economy is you can't move an office building. And so one of the problems as you try to organize a global union in many industries is the employers say, if you strike in one country, I'll just move your jobs. But what happens in the service industry is the jobs can't be moved. So it allows you to unite people in a different way because the boss doesn't have the same hammer over your head, which is if you engage in solidarity and support action, I'll move.
I mean, why can't the boss move? He wants to have the hotel there or the restaurant there or the
hospital. I mean, there's a reason why they're there. They're there in the office building or the hotel because that's where their market is, and so they'd be committing suicide to move. And what you really find if you look around the globe is there's 30 or 40 cities now in the world that are becoming the hub and the center of global finance, real estate, and the global service economy. And in those cities, you find increasing numbers of really rich people, and you find increasing numbers of really poor people taking care of them. And you really have this fascinating development, whether it's New York or whether it's Johannesburg, which is the economy is the same, which is first world living standards for the rich and third world living standards for the poor. And so you have this fascinating dynamic of poor people all over the workers who are now all over the world who are now linked together by common employers. So it lets you develop a global strategy. And we just won an agreement from a Swedish security guard company, where they agreed that anywhere in the world that their workers try to organize a union, that they'll agree to recognize a union and negotiate.
Now, that's you as the service employees union, or are you working with a Danish union that's doing the same thing you're doing?
It was us working with the Swedish union and the Swedish transport workers and other unions around the world who have contracts with them. And we all said, if you're going to have good relations in Europe and you're going to have good relations in other countries, then we should have a global policy that respects the rights of workers to organize. And we won that because we campaigned for it globally.
And to what extent did you win because it was a Swedish company, which may be in a more enlightened frame of mind in an enlightened country?
I think it's part of good strategies to figure out where you're most likely to win, and it definitely helped that it was Swedish. But we actually are having similar discussions with companies around the world, and what we're And really our goal here is to say, let's look at some of the biggest outsourced companies in the world, these contractors that operate all over the world, and then let's also look at the entities that contract out to them, the big banks, and demand that people recognize the right to have a union, and also that they then start to put the money into paying people. And we sort of are starting to develop this theory that we're calling the rent-to-wage ratio.
And what is that?
Well, it's this interesting thing that if you look at the rent that people pay for offices around the world, increasingly, to put it simply, they're expensive everywhere. Even in undeveloped country, you might pay the same thing for to rent office space as you do in the United States. So why is it if the rental rates are comparable to U.S. rental rates, should a worker make a hundredth of what a worker makes here? There's not an economic argument. So you have a global corporation that opens an office in Johannesburg. They're paying 80% as much to rent the space in Johannesburg as they are in Indianapolis, but they pay a tenth as much. So we want to put pressure on those global companies saying that they need to have a wage policy everywhere in the world that lets people have a living wage.
So when you're negotiating globally, you don't say your workforce is going to get X dollars an hour everywhere, but the dollar per hour wage or benefit package would vary country to country.
Well, what we're actually saying, we haven't done this yet. I said this is a theory, is what we're trying to do is get beyond the notion that if you're in a poor country, you should be poor. In a way to think about it, if you think back to when the Pullman car porters organized in the United States originally, they negotiated a national wage rate. And even if they went home to a small town where wages were low, they didn't make less money. If they went back to a small Alabama town, they got the same wage rate nationally. And what we're saying is that if global corporations in developing countries can charge first world rents, then we should start talking about how they pay first world wages to the people who take care of those properties.
Do you have a particular corporation or industry in mind that you were going to try to tackle globally first?
Well, I mean, we're first looking at two things, property service janitors, cleaners, and also security officers, which are two interrelated industries which are totally outsourced, where the workforce is increasingly migrants or immigrants, where the wages are horrible, but the entities who control their wages are incredibly powerful and wealthy.
Stephen Lerner, we only have about a minute left. You talked about a lot of what the labor movement has done wrong and then some things that the labor movement is doing right now. A lot of times when people talk about unions, they just see the numbers go down. Why do you have a sense that this is an exciting time to be in the labor movement?
Well, one, because the work we're doing is more important than ever in history, that there's the greatest disparity of wealth, more people losing health care, more problems. So the importance of unions is as great or greater than ever. And every day I'm with workers who are risking their jobs, who are taking incredible chances to make their lives better. And when I think about the hunger strikers at the University of Miami and this wonderful woman who said, when asked if she was afraid to die, if she was going to die on the 16th day of her fast, said, "I am not afraid of dying because our cause is just and God won't let me die." She won. Those workers won. It's spreading all over the country, and I think we're going to see incredible things in the years ahead.
Well, that's an upbeat story. Stephen Lerner, director of the SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign. You can get to SEIU at SEIU.org, I believe, on the web. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.